The series of graphics on the large monitor installed on the end wall of the Roosevelt Room, opposite the portrait of President Teddy Roosevelt as a Rough Rider. "Thank you, Madam President," Secretary Gregg began. "I want to address our defensive posturing and generalities first, and then look at our specific deployments. First screen, please. Currently, we have 36 interceptors, 32 at Fort Greely in Alaska and 4 at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Our mobile interceptors consist of Aegis destroyers equipped with ship-based missile systems deploying Raytheon Standard Missile 3 short- and intermediate-range ballistic missiles. The SM-3 has advanced avionics, which can track and destroy an ICBM mid-flight. As you can see from the graphic, however, the reaction time and the margin of error associated with destroying an ICBM based upon our Aegis position is not optimal. During the boost phase, minutes after launch, the ICBM will be difficult to intercept. Let me add, however, that the change of locale from Mount Mantap to Kusong allows our destroyers a few additional vital seconds to accomplish this task." The president got out of her chair and walked toward the monitor. "You show the Block 2A as under development. I understood during last year's budget battle that continuation of this project was necessary because it was near completion. Was that incorrect?"
"No, Madam President," replied Secretary Gregg. "The SM-3 Block 2A, a joint effort between Raytheon and Mitsubishi, is fully operational and ready for deployment to the Japanese Navy. It hasn't been tested yet by our Navy, so the Pentagon hasn't provided its final stamp of approval for deployment on our vessels."
"Has Japan tested the new technology?" asked the President.
"Yes, with limited success," replied Secretary Gregg. "But I'm not willing to pass judgment on its effectiveness until our people have conducted a controlled test."
"Let me ask this, hypothetically," began the president. "Could we deploy this SM-3 and test it on the DPRK's upcoming ICBM launch?"
"We could, Madam President, but that could have serious repercussions," answered the Secretary of State, before Secretary Gregg could answer. "This could be seen as a provocation and an act of war."
"We are already at war," said Secretary Gregg with a snarky tone. "Let me remind everyone, the Korean War never ended with the Korean Armistice Agreement. They just hit the pause button. Make no mistake, Kim Jong-un looks at our relationship that way."
"Point taken, Mr. Secretary," said Acton. "Yet we've managed to avoid shooting at one another for nearly 70 years. Why start now?"
"Okay, perhaps it was a bad idea," said the president, as she found her way back to her chair. Secretary Gregg resumed his presentation.
"Madam President, to answer your question," he started, providing the Secretary of State a dirty look, "the bigger problem with your hypothetical is if the new Block 2A technology fails to bring down their ICBM, the ramifications of a failed intercept could be much greater than a successful one."
"Understood," said the president. Secretary Gregg nodded to his aide.
"Next slide, please. This graphic illustrates our existing missile defense program, and it allows me to point out the various defense weaponry at our disposal. From the Sea of Japan to the coast of California, we've deployed a variety of defenses to bring down a North Korean, Russian, or Chinese nuke. For years, many in Congress have questioned the Defense Department's expenditures on the THAAD system and the Aegis Ashore deployments as overkill. There's something I need to make perfectly clear to everyone. Shooting down an ICBM in mid-flight is not as simple as sitting behind a computer console like you're playing a video game, and it's never been done under live fire conditions such as a North Korean launch. In 20 years, we've only conducted 18 tests, and individually, these systems only took down 10 rockets. That's less than 60% per target and less than realistic conditions." The attendees in the Roosevelt Room began to mumble among themselves. The president whispered to her chief of staff, who began to scribble some notes on a pad. Secretary Gregg allowed this number to sink in for a moment, and then continued. "Now, that's not to say we can't successfully bring an ICBM down. Based upon the Pentagon's computer models with most likely assumptions, we believe it would take 4 to 5 of our interceptors to give us a 97% success probability."
"Mr. Secretary, what you're saying is we would have to expend 5 of our available interceptors to knock out one of their ICBMs?
That's correct, Madam President, he replied.
With simple math, if they fired 7 at us in any manner of succession, we would have exhausted our defenses against future missiles from North Korea or any other source, correct?
In theory, yes, Madam President, replied Secretary Gregg. The deduction you've reached is why the Defense Department has been ringing the clarion bell for decades about North Korea's nuclear proliferation. With every successful test, and with the continued passage of time, this rogue state can build up an arsenal that can overwhelm our existing defense levels, leaving us no choice but to react with our own offensive capabilities.
You mean a nuclear war? Asked President Harmon.
Secretary Gregg stood a little taller and pulled his jacket a little tighter in the front. In this case, pardon the colloquialism, the best defense would have to necessarily include a much better offense.
Chapter 22. November 7th. The Roosevelt Room. The White House. Washington, D.C.
The room began to settle down after the realities of Secretary Gregg's revelations struck them. He believed in the axiom that fear was a great motivator. Sometimes, in order to move someone to act, it took blunt, straight talk, with a tinge of embellishment, to achieve the desired result. Although the means might be questioned, the end result, a better prepared, safer America, was worthy.
Secretary Gregg, I think we all fully understand what our defensive capabilities are, and clearly there is no margin of error, started the President. Before we move on to part two of our briefing, could you tell me what kind of time frames we'd be working under in the event of an attack?
Secretary Gregg nodded and leaned over to his aide, who efficiently produced another graphic.
Madam President, I think you'll find this slide self-explanatory. It's based upon our understanding of the DPRK's technological capabilities. He continued, as you can see, at just 20 minutes flight time, Hawaii would be the most vulnerable. But our opinion is that it's not a primary target for the North Koreans. Most likely they'd seek out large population centers on the U.S. mainland. Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, and of course Washington.
When would our interceptors deploy? And where would they engage the ICBMs? Asked the President.
Secretary Gregg responded, under our current state of readiness, Madam President, Greeley and Vandenberg would react immediately. Most likely they would intercept the ICBMs over the middle of the Pacific Ocean, approximately halfway through their projected flight time to the continental U.S. of roughly 36 minutes.
If they miss, would we get a second chance?
Possibly. But it would be with marginal success, replied Secretary Gregg. Once the ICBMs re-enter the Earth's atmosphere during the terminal phase, they continue until impact or detonation. This stage takes less than a minute for a strategic warhead, which can be traveling at speeds greater than 2,000 miles per hour.
What are our capabilities? Asked Acton.
The THAAD system. THAAD was an acronym for Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, which was designed as the ultimate hit-to-kill interceptor for short- and medium-range ballistic missiles. The systems had been successfully deployed in Europe along Russia's borders and into South Korea as a defense against North Korean missile attacks. The THAAD system does engage ballistic missiles during the terminal stage, but the re-entry speed of a long-range ICBM would make its success rate very low, replied Secretary Gregg.
Our only defense is the GMD, ground-based interceptors, we've already discussed. Frankly, that's why we've always suggested utilizing our first strike options to keep the war on their side of the Pacific.
Secretary Gregg leaned over to his aide and advised him to leave the graphic up on the screen for now. He wanted the short time frames for the destruction of Los Angeles and other major cities to sink into the President's psyche.
Okay, let's shift gears, said President Harmon. I'm not going to get into the geopolitical ramifications of a first strike upon North Korea. I want to focus strictly on the mechanics. Unfortunately, we're up against an adversary who seems to have adopted a survival-at-all-costs approach in dealing with the rest of the world. I won't go so far as to say he welcomes a military conflict,
but he sure doesn't appear to be willing to back down from one.
Madam President, that is a correct assessment, added Secretary Gregg. I'm a believer in studying the history of warfare when planning. All military engagements provide us something to consider when making decisions about future conflicts. I'd like to say something about the 2003 invasion of Iraq, which we all know as the Iraq War. I know that many in this room, in hindsight, argued against our reasoning and stated rationale for entering Iraq. I don't wish to relitigate that now. What I will point out is that we chose to take the fight to the enemy on their soil, not ours. Granted, Iraq was in no position to invade America, although terrorists obviously were not afraid to do so. The end result, after many years, was a free and democratic Iraq, a weakened Iran, and the death of the radical Islamists who fought for ISIS.
President Harmon leaned back in her chair and clasped her fingers in her lap. Secretary Gregg, are you suggesting we need to strike North Korea first because they might invade the United States? Surely Kim Jong-un is not that stupid.
On the contrary, Madam President, I think this dictator is quite cunning, and just as important, fearless, said Secretary Gregg. A war on U.S. soil could, by definition, include a nuclear attack, as well as a subsequent ground war. The Pentagon suggests a preemptive strike against the North Koreans to back them down, by showing them who's the boss.
Please explain, said the President.
We have at the ready, Madam President, awaiting your orders, a squadron of B-1 Lancer heavy bombers located at Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. The B-1 has the largest internal payload of any bird in our arsenal. We suggest sending 3 pairs of B-1 bombers simultaneously to pre-identified locations across North Korea. Each plane has a max payload of 168 500-pound bombs. Our stealth attack would have a devastating impact on North Korea and would effectively shut down their nuclear program and quite possibly eliminate Kim Jong-un himself if we can confirm his whereabouts.
Secretary of State Tompkins spoke up. In recent years, his exact location has only been based upon speculation. Only members of his tight inner circle know for sure.
Let me add this. Regarding the political aspect and the world's reaction to our proposal, Secretary Gregg said, we've specifically suggested the B-1 Lancers because they are not capable of carrying nuclear weapons, and the other major powers, including North Korea, know that. We would be sending a signal to our nations that our goal is not to obliterate the North Korean people or make a bad situation worse. Our goal continues to be, and always has been, arresting their nuclear proliferation.
Chief of Staff Acton spoke up.
The sheer number of bombs you suggest dropping, over 1,000 by my count, would necessarily kill many thousands of innocent Koreans and likely destroy their critical infrastructure. Wouldn't this compel Kim Jong-un to respond with his nukes?
Not if they're destroyed by our birds, replied Secretary Gregg, who had always labeled Acton as a dove on military matters.
Madam President, within 30 minutes of entering North Korean airspace, we could wipe them out. We've already been sending B-1s near their airspace as a show of force. Under our strategy, Pyongyang would think it's more bluster on our part, until it was too late.
What about loss of life on our side? Could our pilots be shot down? Asked the President.
Madam President, my boys are ready to do their duty in defense of their country, replied Secretary Gregg. When called upon, they will act with precision and honor.
Our boys, Secretary Gregg, said the President. The room grew silent as the President and her defense secretary studied one another. Neither was prepared to continue. For Secretary Gregg, this was the President's last chance to sign off on the military's preemptive strike option. If she didn't, the deep state's covert plan would move forward. All he knew was that the time to act had passed long ago. It might be too late.
Ladies and gentlemen, stated President Harmon, do I have military options?
Of course I do. As Commander-in-Chief, that's my responsibility to consider both military and diplomatic approaches to solving an international crisis. We always want to use diplomacy as our first choice, because it doesn't involve killing innocent people on their side or the loss of life in our military. Overall, I consider our defenses to the North Korean nuclear threat to be robust. I believe we have the capability to shoot down an ICBM directed at America. And once we do, then we'll evaluate whether a nuclear retaliation is necessary, or perhaps we'll go the route of the B-1 bombers. Until then, we'll stay the course. Thank you, Secretary Gregg, for your comprehensive presentation. The president stood and immediately left the room, her chief of staff and political strategist in tow. Secretary Gregg tried to compose himself before he screamed out loud what he was thinking. Comprehensive presentation? This was not a PowerPoint dog and pony show for a bunch of suits in a boardroom. I'm trying to avoid an all-out nuclear war. I'm done. Chapter 23. November 7th. Home of Secretary of Defense Montgomery Gregg. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Another late-night meeting was called at the Georgetown home of Secretary Gregg. Once again, the attendees included Carl Braun, director of the Special Activities Division, and Billy Yancey, head of the Political Action Group. For purposes of the shadowy relationship these men shared, titles and positions didn't matter, other than the access they afforded the men. There was no hierarchy, although Secretary Gregg, as a member of the president's cabinet, was given considerable respect in the decision-making process. By their very nature, the activities engaged in by men such as these was long-lasting and much bigger than the individuals meeting on this particular evening. Over the years, new recruits would be brought in under the veil of secrecy, as men like Gregg, Braun, and Yancey retired to their ranches, mountain homes, and Caribbean retreats. Gentlemen, I've tried my best to sway the president to do the right thing without outright lying to her, started Secretary Gregg. Of course, Acton and that political hack Jennings can go dig up their own military experts to disagree with me, but at least I was able to put our best foot forward and get it on the record. Billy Yancey, who understood the political aspects of the president's decision better than his counterparts, spoke first. I believe the president recognizes that generals and admirals, speaking through you, have more experience on these issues than she does or her politically oriented advisory team. She won't deny herself the benefits of your wisdom. What we can't accomplish is changing her core political belief that the best solution to dealing with a tyrant like Kim Jong-un is diplomacy. He doesn't care about diplomacy. And biding time, interjected Braun, he learned from his father and achieved far more technologically than expected. Well, I think we can thank the Iranians for that, said Secretary Gregg. Braun removed several folded documents from his coat pocket and handed them to Yancey and Secretary Gregg. What's this? Asked Yancey. New intel just obtained from our friends at MI6, replied Braun. We believe these manifests establish a connection between Ukrainian-built rocket engines and North Korea via Iran. Secretary Gregg studied the paperwork and looked up to Braun. Tell me what all of this means. To bottom line it, the Security Service of Ukraine, or SBU, the country's successor to the KGB, were working with an informant on a sting trying to bust two North Korean spies while stealing rocket technology years ago. The SBU turned the spies, and they've been working for the Ukrainians since. The spies gave these manifests to the SBU, who in turn sent them to MI6. I see the translator's notes in the margins, said Secretary Gregg. This appears to show the Ukrainians selling rocket engines to the Iranians. Exactly. And based upon our interrogations of the crew of the Fu Chao, it appears those same rocket engines have been traded to North Korea in exchange for the satellite technology. Is there an obligation to take this to the president? Asked Yancey. Braun started laughing. Did you seriously just ask that question, Billy? The president sees what we want her to see. Besides, my contact at MI6 is, shall I say, a like-minded thinker when it comes to Whitehall. Whitehall is a road in Westminster located in central London. It's the recognized center of the government of the United Kingdom, including the Ministry of Defense and the cabinet offices. Silly me, Yancey chuckled. Okay, so this intel is need to know as far as we're concerned. My feeling is that the president wouldn't change her position if she had access to this. He set the documents on the coffee table next to the fireplace.
Agreed, said Secretary Gregg. I don't think it should change our course of action. I need to address one concern of mine before we adjourn.
What's that, Monty? Asked Yancey.
It's the matter of the sister, Kim Yo-jong.
Are you both certain she can be trusted? I mean, her reason for helping us is sound, but everything I've read about her is that she is fiercely loyal to her brother.
I understand, Monty. So let me address your concerns, because I had them as well when Carl and I first broached the topic, said Yancey. After our little dictator ordered the hit on his brother Kim Jong-nam in Kuala Lumpur, the National Clandestine Service decided to dig even deeper into his family ties. Ordering the death of his brother using the VX nerve agent was incredibly brutal, much worse than a quick and simple gunshot to the back of the head. Kim Jong-un was sending a message to his brother and the rest of his siblings. Defy me and you will suffer immeasurable pain in your death. The VX nerve agent, short for Venomous X, used by the two female assassins, was extremely toxic. A victim of a VX chemical attack usually died from asphyxiation due to not being able to exhale. Yancey continued. His other brother, Kim Jong-chul, has lived a life of exile outside North Korea. He seems to spend most of his time in London, attending rock concerts. Big Eric Clapton fan, and quite the guitarist in his own right, we're told, interrupted Braun. He has an older sister, Kim Sul-song, who's never been photographed, continued Yancey. She is rumored to be the father's favorite child. Our intel has revealed she has played a secretive, yet significant role in the propaganda department of Kim Jong-un's regime. Secretary Gregg held up his hand, causing Yancey to pause. Wouldn't she be the heir apparent after we kill her brother?
Not likely, mainly because of bloodlines, replied Braun. Kim and his sister, Kim Yo-jong, have the same mother. The two studied together in Bern, Switzerland. When their father died, she was close by his side, and she was instrumental in helping him consolidate power. Like her half-sister, Kim Yo-jong has spent a considerable amount of time in the DPRK's propaganda department. Her elevation to the country's Politburo 5 years ago sealed her position as his closest confidant. Gregg added his copy of the Ukrainian documents to the pile. Braun gathered them up and tossed them into the fire. The three men sat in silence as the paperwork burned.
What's the worst-case scenario if she's playing us? Asked Secretary Gregg.
It won't matter if they're killed or captured. The team we've identified is deep cover, so we can easily disavow any knowledge or involvement, replied Yancey. One of the men is of South Korean descent, which will point the DPRK's attention toward their own, or at least in the direction of North Korea.
What about the other operative? Asked Secretary Gregg.
Yancey nodded and smiled as he sat back in his chair.
Good man, very reliable. And you'll like this. He's a fellow Texan.
Secretary Gregg smiled as well. I've always said, give me an army of West Point grads and I'll win a battle. Give me a handful of Texas Aggies and I'll win a war. Maybe this young man from Texas can help us prevent one.
Chapter 24. November 8th, the Moody Theater. Block 21, Austin, Texas. A jubilant crowd of 2,500 Texans crowded the stage at the Moody Theater, home to the famed Austin City Limits music program, which had been running in Austin since the mid-1970s. Block 21, a hugely popular mixed-use development in downtown Austin, partnered with the Moody Foundation in Galveston to create the music venue, which became home to the longest-running live music television program in American history. ACL Live presented music lovers of all genres, especially country, the finest in performances. But on this night, the Moody was packed full of supporters of newly re-elected Governor Marion Burnett. Even though all the votes were not yet tallied, Governor Burnett's opponent had already conceded, just an hour after the polls closed. As the television monitors throughout the venue began to reveal the results,
the Burnett faithful began to whip themselves up into a joyous celebration. After the local media reported that the concession call had been made, chants of Texas strong, Texas free filled the hall. Governor Burnett began her remarks with the customary condolences to her opponent and thanks to her team for their efforts. After several mundane remarks pulled directly from her stump speech about her vision for the future, she broached the topic her political handlers constantly reminded her to avoid during the campaign. Secession. "My fellow Texans, I did not run a campaign attempting to hide who I am. Y'all know my mouth is too big for that, right? While I'm committed to governing for the best interests of all Texans, I don't intend to compromise my principles for those who disagree with me. What I intend to do is disprove those naysayers who label my policies as isolationist, projectionist, or, God forbid, secessionist." The crowd roared their approval at the word secessionist. The chanting began again in earnest. "Texas strong, Texas free, Texas strong, Texas free." Governor Burnett continued, "Texans aren't un-American, and don't you let the media up east convince you that you are. I refuse to allow the media to define us. So if you people in New York City are paying attention, let me tell you about Texans. We're proud of our culture. Texans share a common way of life, which revolves around family, religion, and community. Our core beliefs may differ slightly, but in the end, we want Texas to be a great place to raise a family, start a business, and live free of burdensome laws that don't reflect our values. Texas has a proud history, one that reflects self-reliance, freedom, and a sense of pride that is unparalleled across the country. In every aspect of our lives, we choose freedom. My friends, God bless Texas, and we thank him daily without hesitation." Again, the crowd erupted in cheers and celebration. "Texas strong, Texas free, Texas strong, Texas free." She allowed her supporters their moment. They'd worked hard year-round to push her over the finish line and election to another term in office. This party was for them as much as it was for her. "Let me school the media and those folks in California who tried their darndest to influence this election. We Texans are a proud bunch, and we are also diverse. From El Paso to Brownsville and from Lubbock to Texarkana, this state is made up of all types of races, ethnic groups, religions, and cultures. Texas belongs to all of us, not just those who voted for me. It was given to us by God, and it will be enjoyed by our families for so long as we treat it with respect. There is no us versus them among fellow Texans, is there?" "No," shouted the crowd in response. But this election did send a clear message to outsiders who attempted to meddle in our affairs during this election, and in other ways daily. "You stay out of our business and don't mess with Texas." The crowd cheered once again. Governor Burnett invoked an often used phrase that had evolved as a battle cry of sorts for Texans. In actuality, "Don't Mess with Texas" was created as part of an anti-litter campaign decades ago. As the excitement subsided, Governor Burnett took on a more sober demeanor. "My friends, I'd like to take a moment to get serious about our future. The campaign is over. The election reflected the will of Texans, and now it's time for me to continue working on your behalf. I'm a proud Christian, as I know most of you are. I've often been asked by the media, how can you reconcile being a Christian and working in the cutthroat world of politics? God has blessed me with this opportunity to help our state be a better place to live for all of his children. I believe the people of God should be a blessing to our culture, not be removed from it. Our founding fathers provided us the greatest country on earth, one that is rare in history. We can be directly involved. We can vote and have a say in how we are governed, and the words of Peter, Paul, and Joseph confirmed in the Bible that we should. Like any political leader, I believe I have a vision for Texas that's in the best interest of every Texan. Now, in order to carry out that vision, I must get elected, and then, like tonight, get re-elected. That requires gathering votes during the election process, which is a necessary result of being popular with the voters. I will tell you, I face a crossroads from time to time in my political values, in which the right thing to do is not necessarily the popular thing to do. I try to inform the people of Texas on the issues, and I listen to their feedback. Then I turn to God for guidance. The book of Proverbs says, if you are faint in the day of adversity, your strength will be small. My friends, it is in our most difficult days that we must be strong. When evil tries to gain control over us, that is when we must stand tall. We must be heroes when life demands us to be heroes. I'm not necessarily talking about a war between nations. I'm talking about a war between cultures with differing morals, values, and core beliefs. Our nation is divided as it's entered a hyper-political climate. The so-called blue states have become bluer, and red states have become redder as like-minded individuals relocate to be with others of their point of view. Sadly, we may never see eye to eye on anything except an external threat. My friend Reverend Tommy Nelson, pastor of the Denton Bible Church, said it best when he referred to it as a continental divide among the American people. The polarization of our nation is at an all-time high. My goal is to eliminate this rancid political discourse in our state by bringing all of us, regardless of race, sex, or whatever, together as Texans. We will be Texans first, if need be. And if Washington and a mouthy few in the Northeast media or on the West Coast can't accept who we are, then they can learn to live without us. Because make no mistake, my friends, under my stewardship, we can separate ourselves from the madness that has overtaken America. The solution is Texas strong, Texas free.
Chapter 25. November 9th. U.S. Naval Forces Central Command, NSA Bahrain.
Duncan and Park had been airlifted from the flight deck of the USS Jack H. Lucas as it was en route back to U.S. Naval Forces Central Command, NAVCENT, located at Naval Support Activity Bahrain. Two teams were left aboard the Singapore-flagged Fu Chau as it was taken into custody per Washington's instructions. The crew was being brought into NAVCENT for interrogation and further disposition. Immediately upon boarding the Sikorsky SH-60 Seahawk, an ensign provided Duncan a sealed packet and access to a Microsoft laptop computer. When the men were notified by Captain Abbey that they would be returned to NSA Bahrain immediately, the adrenaline that had filled their bodies during the search of the Fu Chau returned out of apprehension. The 300-mile flight across the tip of the United Arab Emirates provided them plenty of time to review their new deployment orders. Anxious to learn about their new mission, Duncan booted the laptop. Inside the envelope, there was a note card with an alphanumeric code, meaningless to most people, but one that had been established by Duncan before they left Langley months ago. It was a combination of the date Dallas had been killed in action and his brother's initials. This code was a message advising Duncan that the information he'd be accessing was for their eyes only. It also indicated to him that he'd need to insert the 128-gigabyte USB drive that he kept in his possession. The flash drive contained software that allowed him to access the CIA's secure network designed solely for his benefit and his superiors. He responded to a series of security questions, and then he was able to review his messages on the secure server. The first message indicated he could share the information with Park. "All right, buddy," started Duncan, as he flexed his fingers and took a deep breath. He turned the laptop screen so that both he and Park could view its display. The men cozied up in the back of the SH-60 as its twin turboshaft rotors propelled it at nearly 10,000 feet above the water at 140 miles per hour. "Let's see what they got in store for us." "Looks like the first stop is Misawa Air Base," said Park. "I've never passed through there. Have you?"
"Nope. Not really familiar with it either," replied Duncan.
Misawa Air Base was located in a remote location in the northeast of Japan. It was a joint installation of the Air Force, Navy, and Army, but it fell primarily under the purview of the 35th Fighter Wing. It has a long history dating back to the Korean War, Park said, as he followed along with Duncan through their redeployment instructions. It also acts as a staging area for special ops related to China. My guess is we're going into the land of the Red Dragon. Duncan continued to read through the messages, and then clicked on a link marked Logistics. Maps, images, and biographies of various people were made available. Park, have you actually been to Korea? Asked Duncan. Yeah, when I was like 3 years old with my parents. Why? He asked, as he leaned forward to study the monitor. Wait. Really? Really. We're going into North Korea, replied Duncan. Why? I thought our friends at Langley liked us. Duncan looked at his partner. To be determined. Why do you say that? Because operatives who go into North Korea usually don't come back out. Chapter 26. November 9th. Undisclosed Military Command Center, north of Pyongyang, North Korea. Since the Korean War, the Kim regimes had become masters of putting their critical command and control facilities of the military underground. Many of their military command structures have been buried deep under mountains, oftentimes obscured by factories or transportation facilities. To avoid prying eyes from above, the buildings on the surface appeared unassuming. But underneath, a series of wide tunnels and cavernous openings built by political prisoners rivaled the underground facilities at Cheyenne Mountain. North Korea was expert at keeping secrets from the outside world. Political dissent was met with immediate, oftentimes deadly punishments. Access to the World Wide Web via the Internet was forbidden and made impossible by the state's control over communications. Their technology and tight controls prevented outside media like Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty from being piped into the country. This veil of secrecy had served them well and was instrumental in allowing them to forge a close working relationship with another rogue nation who had the United States as a common enemy, Iran. For decades, Iran and North Korea had shared missile and satellite technology. American intelligence also worked overtime to establish tangible proof of cooperation between the two nation-states in the nuclear arena. It was the Iranians who taught the North Koreans to exploit the West's penchant for interconnectivity. Pyongyang learned an enemy that had internet-connecting banking, stock trading, critical infrastructure, and social media was vulnerable to cyber warfare. The Kim regime learned that the opportunities to wreak havoc via cyber attacks were endless. North Korea had become experts at ransomware, including WannaCry, which had held online hospital records hostage until a fee was paid. Several years ago, North Korean hackers had compromised computers in Seoul, stealing a vast cache of data, including highly classified wartime contingency plans jointly prepared by the Pentagon and South Korea. All of this information was routinely shared with the Iranians, with whom they'd shared a military alliance since the 1980s. Iran's Qatar-class submarines were virtually identical to North Korea's Yonah-class. The Iranians had recently tested missiles that were identical in design to the North Koreans. And 8 months ago, the Iranians launched a satellite into low Earth orbit that appeared to be a copy of the North Korean KMS-4, launched by Pyongyang 6 years ago. This collaborative military-to-military relationship was underscored when leaders from both countries met in open defiance of U.S. policymakers during the United Nations General Assembly vote on the sanctions package. The headline emblazoned across newspapers worldwide read, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend." While the two countries were hardly enemies, these emerging regional powers had gained the upper hand in world opinion over the U.S. Deep underground, in the mountains hidden behind an automobile parts factory, Kim Jong-un, through an interpreter, spoke directly to Iran's President Hassan Rouhani. They discussed their trade agreements in violation of international sanctions. They agreed that the recent capture of the North Korean scientists and the satellite meant nothing. They pledged to escalate their own wartime military plans. The two men, despite their vast differences in culture and ideology, truly enjoyed one another's company. They laughed together when a date was agreed upon for the demise of the Great Satan, as the Iranians referred to the United States. The axis of evil, hidden behind multiple layers of secrecy, had reached an accord, one that was decades in the making.
Chapter 27. November 9th. The Oval Office. The White House. Washington, D.C.
President Harmon joined Acton and Jennings in the Oval Office for coffee, prior to the President's daily brief. PDB for short, the President's daily brief, took place in the Roosevelt Room and focused on national security issues. The briefing usually lasted around 30 minutes and was attended by key members of the national security team, but not necessarily members of the President's cabinet. President Harmon routinely attended these briefings, but mostly looked to her chief of staff and senior political advisor to discuss matters of utmost importance. Today, she wanted to address the issue of Iran and North Korea, but the initial conversation over coffee revolved around the national headlines out of Austin. Governor Burnett's speech the night before had struck a nerve with the media and political pundits. "I personally don't understand what the big deal is," started President Harmon. "She's clearly playing to her base. Did you watch the excerpts they showed on CNN?"
"Actually, I watched the entire acceptance speech," replied Jennings. "None of the midterm congressional races were nearly as intriguing as the governor's ability to fire up her supporters."
The president took a sip of coffee and shook her head. "True, but wasn't it just a lot of noise, especially when she constantly alludes to secession? They don't really buy into that garbage down there, do they?"
"Don't underestimate her message," replied Acton. "She has a clear and convincing state-centric nationalist approach to governing."
"Okay, Charles, that was a mouthful," the president chuckled. "Would you break it down for me?"
"Of course, Madam President. Typically, a candidate for president who advances a nationalism platform, like the prior administration, runs on 5 core issues: shared culture, proud history, common religion, everyday language, and national boundaries." She struck the same tones during her speech, but she applied these principles to Texas.
"It was as if she was looking at Texas as its own country," interjected the president.
"Exactly. Here's an interesting thing about Texas that isn't known by a lot of people outside their state, but it's something that is taught in every elementary school there," started Jennings, the political whiz and a student of American history. "You've heard of Six Flags Over Texas, right?"
"Sure. It's an amusement park," replied the president. "We have something similar in L.A. called Six Flags Over Magic Mountain."
"Okay, that's true, but it's not what I'm referring to," continued Jennings. "It was originally used as a slogan to describe the flags of the 6 different nations that have flown over Texas. Throughout its history, Texas has been claimed by Spain, France, Mexico, the Confederacy, the United States, and in the mid-19th century it was its own republic. There are many Texans, led by Governor Burnett, who believe the days when Texas was its own republic, a sovereign nation, should be resurrected."
The president finished her coffee and set the cup on the table in front of them.
"Listen, I was in San Francisco when they started talking that secession nonsense and creating the state of Jefferson. It went nowhere. Then, after the 2016 election, the pendulum swung in the other direction, and the entire state wanted to split into several parts. They called it Calexit. It also faded away."
"I believe Texas is a little different, Madam President," said Jennings. "Last spring, they passed the Texas Sovereignty Act, which allows for overriding federal laws through the same process their legislature has for passing a bill in the State House. A request to nullify a federal law's enforcement in Texas would have to be proposed, passed through committee, and receive the votes in the Texas legislature. If the governor signed it, then the federal law would be avoided within the state."
Chief of Staff Acton nodded his agreement.
"Madam President, Arizona and Maine have passed similar legislation. The concept is gaining traction in other southern states."
"Yes, but that's a far cry from secession."
"Is secession even legal?" she asked.
"I thought we resolved that after the Civil War, when Lee and Grant met at the Appomattox courthouse."
Acton responded,
"It's my understanding that most constitutional scholars say no, because it's legally impossible.
The Constitution has no provision allowing secession. The Supreme Court, in a case dealing with Texas following the Civil War, called the United States an indestructible union. Justice Antonin Scalia once wrote, "The one constitutional issue resolved by the Civil War was that there is no right to secede." "One thing is certain," said President Harmon. "If they tried to secede, they'd have a heck of a legal battle on their hands all the way to the Supreme Court." She checked her watch and stood, as it was time to walk across the hall to the Roosevelt Room. "Madam President, before we go in, I wanted to let you know I've scheduled a meeting with the Chinese ambassador for Monday, as you requested." "Good. It's time for us to exercise a little muscle on North Korea, via their neighbors."
Chapter 28. November 9th. The Armstrong Ranch, Borden County, Texas. The Armstrong family had gathered around the table for a breakfast of scrambled eggs, country ham and red-eyed gravy, and grits, of course. Major had turned over the early morning feed chores to Preacher once again, who'd been very successful at the cattle auction. The Armstrong steers had brought the high end of the weighted average, which was in the range of $150 per hundredweight, roughly $1,100 per steer. The cow-calf pairs had fared well at $1,600. In simple terms, most cattle ranchers went to the bank each year to borrow the money to operate their ranches until the calves were sold in the fall. If they bought their 500-pound calves in the spring at $1 a pound and then sold them as full-grown steers at the end of the season in October through November before the coldest weather came, they'd double their money, or better. The Armstrong Ranch no longer borrowed money to operate, having reached a level of financial self-sufficiency many years ago. Now Major managed the ranch's income to pay his labor costs and provide for his family. Running as many as 2,000 head each year, the family was more than financially secure. It also enabled Major to invest in improvements to his property, with an eye toward darker times. "Daddy," started Palmer, as she finished off her breakfast and pushed the plate away. She ate nearly as much as her brothers, unashamed to feed her big-boned frame. However, she was blessed with girl-next-door beauty, which had been bestowed upon her by Lucy. "I have to ask you, that's a mighty big hole you've dug out back where the new barn is going. Are you planning a two-story condo for the new quarter horses?" Riley snickered as he sopped up the red-eye gravy with a biscuit. Part of it dribbled down his chin, and he quickly caught it with his sleeve. Despite Miss Lucy's best efforts to instill manners in the boys, she eventually succumbed to their inherent cowboy nature and settled for simply having them potty trained. "Nah, Palmer, nothing like that at all," replied the Major. "Your mom and I have been talking, and we thought it was about time for you three to get a place of your own. So we designed an apartment out there under the barn."
"What?
No way, Daddy," protested Palmer. She looked around the table and then chose her mother. "He's pulling our chain, right, Mama?" Miss Lucy simply shrugged and smiled before Major continued. "Honey, we thought you'd appreciate us putting you closer to your favorite chore, cleaning manure out of the horse stalls." Cooper began laughing and slapped Palmer on the back. "You're so gullible, sis. Ain't none of us gonna have to live underground." "You never know," said Miss Lucy dryly as she stood to clear the table. "This nuclear standoff with the North Koreans has gone to a new level that can lead nowhere good."
"Are you building a bunker, Daddy?" asked Riley.
"We are, son, and I want all of us to be involved. In fact, a lot is going to happen today." Cooper got up from the table and grabbed some more dishes to help his mother.
"I think it makes sense considering what's going on. We could be firing nukes at each other any minute."
"Come on, Daddy, really?" asked Palmer. Major decided to recall the history of the nuclear threat for Palmer's benefit.
"Honey, ever since they used nukes on Japan, the world has feared a nuclear Armageddon where Russia and the U.S. shot at one another."
"I know, Daddy, mutually assured destruction."
Major wiped his mouth with his napkin and pushed away from the table slightly to relax.
"That's right, Palmer. That was a phrase that argued for slowing the proliferation of nuclear arsenals between the two countries. But then China obtained the technology, followed by India and Pakistan. Eventually, it was no longer a Russian-U.S. issue. It became a worldwide issue."
"The Cold War was between Russia and us, right?" asked Riley.
Technically, it was between the old Soviet Union and the United States. But that's basically the same thing. Politicians want to declare the Cold War to be over, but there will always be the potential for the Cold War to become a hot war involving nuclear missiles. Cooper returned from the kitchen and rejoined the conversation.
Whose bright idea was it to give nuclear weapons to those idiots in North Korea?
Yeah, chimed in Riley. I wouldn't trust that fat kid over there to keep his finger off the button, would y'all? Everyone shook their heads from side to side. I think we're all in agreement that a nuclear North Korea is very dangerous, and I believe it's because they have nothing to lose. I'm not saying they'll ever attack us. My personal opinion is that they're building their arsenal to prevent us from attacking them. Personally, I don't know what their long game is, but I do know the threat is real.
Daddy, do you think it's possible to get in a nuclear war with North Korea? I mean, you know, where we shoot at each other?
Palmer seemed genuinely concerned about the prospect of nuclear Armageddon. Major leaned forward and looked his three youngest children in the eye. As you guys know from growing up under this roof, your mama and I have placed great emphasis on self-sufficiency and protecting this family from potential catastrophic events. Now, there's not a whole lot we can do to prevent them from happening, whether they're naturally occurring, like a solar flare, or man-made, like a nuclear war. But we can take steps, as our financial resources allow, to be ready for worst-case scenarios.
Daddy, isn't there a point where somebody might go a little overboard in prepping? Asked Cooper, before adding.
We all watched that show, Doomsday Preppers. Some of them folks were cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, right?
The group laughed, and Major smiled to himself, as he recalled some of the more elaborate preps portrayed on that show.
I can't disagree with that, Coop, replied Major. One good thing that came out of that series, however, is it raised awareness for the concept of prepping. You just had to keep in mind that they were trying to make good television, which is why they portrayed some of the preppers as wackadoos.
Riley started laughing and tried to contain himself.
Yeah, some of it was useful. But I'll be dogged if I'm going to wipe my butt with some dang garden sprayer like that one woman suggested.
Yeah, I could see it now, started Cooper, as he began to laugh hysterically.
You'd be too uncoordinated to spray the nozzle in the right place, and then you'd holler for Mama. Mama, would you please come hose down my butt?
The table burst into laughter at the vision of Riley wandering around behind the barn with his jeans around his ankles, trying to hose down his backside with a garden sprayer.
After the hilarity died down, Major received a text. He read it, and then held up the phone and announced,
That's a text from Preacher. Our delivery has arrived.
Let's go see.
After they hurriedly helped Miss Lucy finish up in the kitchen, the group descended into the cool fall air and marveled at the sight before them. Preacher was on a Polaris and was leading a caravan that consisted of two flatbed trucks and a crane, kicking up dust as they approached.
Are you kidding me? Mumbled Cooper, without really expecting any type of rational answer.
Daddy, you bought two of them? Asked Palmer.
Come on, Major responded, as he led the Armstrong entourage to get a closer look at the steel boxes that rode on the back of the flatbeds.
Let me get them started, and then I'll explain everything.
Major spent a few minutes speaking with Preacher and the installers from Rising S Company, an East Texas-based manufacturer of steel underground storm shelters, safe rooms, bunkers, and bomb shelters. Major had researched a number of companies and found Rising S to be trustworthy and skilled fabricators. He'd toured their plant southeast of Dallas about a year ago and earmarked funds from this year's cattle sales for this purpose. After a moment, the men got to work, and Major returned to his still wide-eyed family.
Let me answer Palmer's question from earlier when she asked if it was possible to go overboard when prepping.
The answer is yes, and I have no doubt some folks might look at this as overboard, but your mama and I see it differently. To us, prepping is like insurance. When we spend our family's money on advanced preps, like these underground bunkers, we're basically ensuring that there will be protection for our families in the event of a catastrophic event, from tornadoes to nuclear strikes.
Daddy, you said families, interjected Riley.
That's right, son. You see Preacher and all of his men? They're our family, too. We provide them housing and locations throughout our ranch. Most of them have been with us for 10 years or more. You've grown up with their kids, and their mothers have become friends of your mothers.
When a major threat forces us into the shelter, we need to make room for them as well. Not only because it's the right thing to do, but because we'll need them to rebuild what's left, and more importantly, defend our homes against those who might want to harm us.
Whoa, Daddy, said Cooper. You think it could come to that? Gun battles with rustlers and such.
It's possible, Coop. And if it's possible, I intend to prep for it. Lucy had been silent for most of the conversation until now.
Come here, kids, she started, as she gestured for her three youngest children to gather next to her. She wrapped her arms around them and whispered, Your daddy and I love you more than life. We'll be dogged if some dictator or a bunch of marauders will take one precious second away from us being together. We'd rather do without than lose any one of you to the threats we face. Do you understand?
Everyone nodded and hugged their mother. For years, Major and Lucy had instilled the concept of self-reliance into their family. Now, as the children had grown into young adults, it was time to get them more involved in the Armstrongs' preparedness activities. They were mature enough to understand and respect the threats all Americans faced. Cooper replied,
We do, Mama. The threats are real. Why not be ready, just in case? Right?
Right, responded Lucy. Chapter 29 November 10th, Midland, Odessa, Texas. While Major and the guys continued work on their underground bunker, Lucy and Palmer made the one-hour trek into Midland, Odessa, to run some errands, which included taking advantage of the Emergency Preparation Supplies sales tax holiday, which had been expanded to twice a year in Texas. The Texas Comptroller first instituted this opportunity for Texans to purchase emergency preparation supplies nearly 10 years ago. Without quantity limits, the waiver of sales tax collection encouraged the public to purchase everything from generators to non-electric can openers. Once restricted to a particular weekend in April, the state comptroller added a second weekend in November following hurricane season. After Hurricane Harvey devastated the Texas Gulf Coast in 2017, then-Governor Abbott suggested the additional weekend be added to encourage Texans to prepare for disasters while the devastation was still fresh on their minds. The program worked and was considered a huge success. Texas had a long history of encouraging its citizens to be ready for major storm events like hurricanes and tornadoes. In addition to protecting human lives, prepping reduced the burden on first responders, who could then focus their attention on the elderly and children, who were not capable of taking care of themselves in these cases. As one preparedness author once wrote, it's the responsible thing to do.
Okay, Mama, what's our first stop? Asked Palmer as they approached Midland from the north on State Highway 349.
Now that Daddy has his nuclear fallout shelter, he's been swooning over since yesterday morning. He wants us to stock it with supplies. We're going to buy backups to a lot of things we already have and secure them in the bunker.
Three is two, two is one, and one is none, right, Mama? Asked Palmer.
Wow, you remember that? Her mother replied with a question.
Yeah, I used to hear that so often when I was little I thought it was a nursery rhyme. But it makes sense. If you only have one generator and it breaks, then you have none.
If something happens like Daddy was talking about yesterday, it's not like we can run down to Tractor Supply and pick up another generator, which means having one is like having none.
Lucy laughed at her daughter's recollection of the prepper's rule of threes.
I'm proud to have instilled something in that brain of yours.
Mama, you've taught me more than you realize, added Palmer. I just don't let on so your head doesn't swell up.
Zip it, Missy, said Lucy with a chuckle, as she wheeled her Ford Expedition into KW Arms. Here's our first stop.
Of course, boy toys, quipped Palmer. Why do they need so many guns?
Actually, there's a special order for your daddy, but I've also picked out a couple of handguns for us.
Are we finally getting those matching Tiffany blue ones? Asked Palmer with a laugh.
No, foo-foo, but we are going to pick up two weapons that are perfect for concealed carry. I have my concealed carry permit, and your daddy wants you kids to get them as well.
But I thought Texas is an open carry state. We don't need the concealed carry permit, do we?
Yes, but this is for when you travel as well, replied Lucy.
Texas, like many states, has entered into concealed carry reciprocity. Most of the states you guys travel to have agreements with Texas.
They pulled into the parking lot,
which was fairly busy for a Thursday morning. They walked in together and immediately realized they were the only women in KW Arms that morning, except for the cashier. Lucy searched the store for Kirk Warwick. The owner,